Yeah, well, the one thing I will ask you right off the bat is, did you realize you're, has anybody ever pointed out that your name is almost a spoonerism on Harry Carney?
You're the first. Are we live now?
Well, I'm recording, but I wasn't necessarily.
Well, I can tell you no. That you're the first person to mention it. And I would reply with, "Did you know that Pepper Adams was born on the day of Harry Carney's death?"
No.
Which is sort of a symbolic passing of the torch, it seems to me. Not to diss anybody in between, but Carney's really the progenitor of the instrument, and Pepper is the modernizer of the instrument. Of course, there are players in between, no doubt. But so I kind of like that too. But yeah, Gary, Harry, Carner, Carney. There you go. I don't think that had anything to do with me choosing Pepper, though. He chose me, actually.
How's that?
Well, essentially, I was doing a master's thesis at City College of New York, CCNY, and it was approved before I even started the program to do an oral history of a jazz musician. So I chose five musicians that I thought I would like to research and write about and interview. Pepper was one of them, and he's the only guy that got back to me. He's the only one to call back. And this is 1984. So this is well before internet, you know. I mean, email and internet really started happening in the very late 80s, as I recall. I got my first computer around then. So, Pepper called back and said he'd love to meet me, and we hit it off, and the rest is history. Here I am 30 years later, more excited than ever.
And Pepper Adams isn't exactly the household name.
Well, he should be. That's something I'm trying to fix. He really should be. That's the topic of my lecture is, the lecture I gave last year was Pepper and his genius, and this year it's about Pepper as a stylist this year. But it's my view that he's one of the great post-war saxophonists, and he's one of the great stylists in jazz. He's immediately identifiable. He wasn't a matinee idol. He wasn't especially handsome. He didn't dress well. He didn't do the Jerry Mulligan routine of going out with actresses and marrying countesses. He wasn't a player. He wasn't a climber. He just was a musician. Musician's musician. And language. You know, there's a bias against low-pitched instruments anyway. If you think about the history of jazz, aren't that many bands led by musicians that played low-pitched instruments? I think of Mingus, maybe John Kirby, way before that. You know, more recently things have become more democratized, but in his lifetime there were very few low-pitched instruments, whether it's trombone or tuba or baritone sax or euphonium, bass, that had leaders that led those bands. It's just a bias against it. We don't hear the whole issue of psychoacoustics that I'll be getting into in my second book, about the bias against low-pitched instruments, that we hear alto and flute much better than we hear low-pitched instruments. That's part of the problem, too, with playing those instruments, is that the lines that you play on a baritone, for example, all tend to rumble and get mushed together. Something Pepper revolutionized through his articulation, through precise tonguing, legato tonguing. So he's a heavy cat, as they say in the trade, a heavy cat.
Well, some of that goes back to the history of jazz and the history of the instrument. Here you have a very large, low-pitched saxophone, which in the early days would be essentially just a baseline instrument, maybe one that could carry a little better in a recording studio than the string bass.
Right.
And then you have very few swing icons on the instrument. Probably the only one that immediately comes to mind would be Harry Carney with the Ellington Orchestra.
Sure, sure. And then Mulligan, too, because he's coming out of a Lester Young swing tradition. There weren't too many people that played the instrument. To Mulligan's credit, he did popularize the instrument, but to his discredit, in some way, he was playing the instrument like an alto sax or a tenor sax, playing a very light style. Pepper eschewed that nicely. I mean, his style was more with a big sound, playing the instrument for all that it had, but to also tame the beast of the baritone. So, that, you know, he was a giant as far as I'm concerned. If you talk to the players, I'm not just talking about baritone players now. I mean, all the baritone players that are playing the instrument now just deify him. He's the exemplar of everything he's supposed to be. But if you talk to the people of his generation, Phil Woods, Lou Tabak and his colleagues, they just have tremendous admiration for him. And, I mean, Phil Woods said he's the greatest we've ever had on the instrument. And I believe that. I think in terms of as a soloist, he was there's no argument as far as I'm concerned that he was the greatest baritone soloist of all time. Just a brilliant, brilliant player. And I'll be discussing that at Western Illinois University on November 1, which is conviently one day after the seventh game of the World Series schedule. So it doesn't get in the way. I'm very happy about that. So hopefully your listeners will come down and hear the lecture. I'll be playing some very obscure Pepper Adams solos from audience recordings that he did in New York and elsewhere, and I'll be showing some video if there's time. I think there will be, actually. Some rare footage of Pepper soloing with the Thad Jones Melodist Orchestra in Europe, in Rotterdam. And I'll be signing copies of my book, which I'm presenting at a very special tour price of $25. So hopefully I'll see all of you folks. So what else can I tell you about Pepper? I mean, I can certainly go for months here, if need be. I've been doing this. You know, I met him in 1984, and I'm still working on the project. So, I mean, just so you know, so the listeners know, I've been working on a multi-volume CD set. We're now about to release CD number 6, which is going to be the University of Illinois Big Band, led by Glenn Wilson, with all their fantastic faculty as soloists, Jim Pugh, Chip McNeil, Chip Stevens, Tito Carrillo, rhythm section of, including Larry Gray and Joel Spencer, really a spectacular date. And then with the student, their top student band, and that's going to be released next January on Motema, and that's my 6th CD. The first 4 were Pepper Adams' complete compositions, all 42 compositions. And the 5th CD was Pepper's ballads with lyrics written by Barry Wallenstein. That project was just spectacular. Alexis Cole is a singer with the great Pat LaBarbera and Eric Alexander on tenor saxophones. So it's a multi-volume project. I've got a few other things that I'm doing. And then the book is out. That just won Best Discography of the Year from the ARSC, which is kind of cool. And I'm moving on to what I always intended to do when I first met Pepper, and that's a full-length biography that I've been working on clearly for a bunch of years.
Well, one of the things interesting about Pepper Adams, usually he's often referred to as perhaps a player who took hard bop or bebop to the baritone saxophone in the style of Parker. But you make a more interesting argument, which is the influence of Art Tatum. Now, for those who might not be familiar with Art Tatum, he was a groundbreaking jazz piano player. And the old rumors, which he denied, but the old rumors were that he learned to play by listening to piano roll recordings of two pianists, and that he thought that that was how the piano should sound, that you should get around it that amazingly. And so that style of piano, that very aggressive full style, you say that Pepper Adams is influenced by.
Well, I don't want to spoil the lecture because then we'll lose our audience, although a lot of the musicians from the jazz program will be there too. But, you know, it's more that Art Tatum was not only a brilliant virtuoso, I mean, you know, a concert-style pianist, you know, like a Rachmaninoff or a Bartok. I mean, you know, had those concert chops. But he had familiar patterns that he worked out, certain 5- and 6-note phrases that he would do with his right hand, either ascending or descending figurations. And this is a style of playing that Charlie Parker adapted and then Pepper Adams adapted to always have a repertoire of licks and cliches and patterns that you can play that sound good over certain chord changes if you get stuck. You can't always be on the top of your game. And you can't always think about the next thing to play. It just sometimes just doesn't happen. So players historically, and still do, develop either their own patterns or they copy Sonny Stitt or John Coltrane patterns to play over certain changes so they have a vocabulary. And Tatum had these patterns and was a very intense pattern player, so I'm going to demonstrate that influence on Pepper, which I believe was Pepper's early influence in the 40s when he was really woodshedding, really spending a lot of time getting his instrument under control. He first started playing the baritone in 47, around Christmas time in 47 in Detroit. But at the same time, he's a pure improviser as well. And the other influence, significant influence, is Wardell Gray, who, unlike Tatum, is virtually obscure at this point. But Wardell Gray was a brilliant, brilliant tenor saxophonist who, had he lived, would have been spoken about. We've been talking about him today as the Stan Getz of tenor sax because he was an incredible melodicist. And so he had a tremendous influence on Pepper as well. He was a mentor in Detroit. And he died within a few months of Charlie Parker at the age of 34 in 1955, which is a personal tragedy for Pepper. Pepper was the pallbearer at the funeral. Oddly enough, at Dick's Funeral Home in Detroit, possibly the most aptly named funeral home of all time. So Pepper pointed that out. Pepper had a tremendous sense of humor, very sly, and you hear that in his playing as well. So I'm going to try to demonstrate, on the one hand, the influence of Wardell Gray and a beautiful melodic behind-the-beat style that comes through Lester Young, and then also the pattern playing of Art Tatum. And that's about all I can handle in one lecture. I could go on and talk about Pepper's use of melodic paraphrase and his use of the diminished scale, which became very popular in Stitt and Coltrane's time in the 50s and on, and various other things, the use of humor, playing things out of key. I mean, he's just a brilliant improviser. But these, to me, are the foundational aspects of Pepper's playing. So I have two solos that really highlight those. And so I'll be playing for the audience on the 1st, November the 1st. 7 o'clock, is it? Is that what you're showing?
I have to look all around.
I think it's 7 to 8:30 and then a book signing after that. Hopefully I can sell some books. You know, Pepper, my book is a discography, but it's annotated. So discography, for those who don't know what those are, is a type of reference work in musicology that lists all the recordings of a given musician. So I have about 730 things that Pepper did, sessions, air checks, acetates, going all the way back to actually before he played the baritone. I got something in Detroit, an acetate with Tommy Flanagan, the great pianist for Ella Fitzgerald for so many years, that was recorded in September, 3 months before Pepper played the baritone. He stole a clarinetist, a young clarinetist coming over from Rochester, New York, coming back to Detroit with his mom after his father had passed away in upstate New York, and all the way up to the last concert he ever did, which is about a month or two before he passed away. It was a concert at the Montreal Jazz Festival. So what I do is I list all this stuff and all the issues and all the nuances of these recordings. But in addition, I have oral history material, so you can actually read the book and learn the behind-the-scenes drama about what happened on this Monk day, why Monk left after two tunes, the drama of things like the crazy town hall concert of Charles Mingus, all these things, and musicians talking about these various dates, which for me would have never made a biography because it was too nuanced about the recordings. So it's just, you know, it wasn't so much about Pepper, it was more about the recordings. So you can actually read the book, but it's the last one you'll ever see in paperback or hardcover. It's sort of an anachronism already because the web has made discographies obsolete. So it's probably the last one that'll ever be done. So maybe you can sell it on eBay then, make it more valuable. You know, $25, you can sell it for $20, $25.03 on eBay. But I hope everybody does come down. Pepper was a wonderful person. I got to know him in the last 2 years of his life. He was diagnosed with lung cancer about 7 months after I met him. And so I was living in New Jersey, in the greater New York area. And would see him perform, and I interviewed him for about 18 hours, and after he passed away, went on to interview as many people as I could, certainly everybody who would be listed in the discography who was still living, just to find out as much about these recordings as I could. It led to all these new discoveries, which is really tremendous. So all this obscure stuff. I also went through Pepper's estate and found all sorts of material that had never been released. There's something on Motown, the four tracks that Thad Jones arranged for Pepper for Jukebox to try to get him more popular that have never been released. And I'm discussing getting released with Universal Records. But I hope people who are curious or who are jazz fans that know the name but just want to connect the music to the name will come down. Quite frankly, I think, as I've said before, he's, besides being a genius in many other facets of his life, our PhD knowledge of our history and American and European music and sports. I mean, he's really a self-taught guy, although he went 5 semesters at Wayne State University in Detroit. Just a brilliant player, musician, and performed with all the great musicians that we could name. So it'll be my pleasure to meet people, and I really appreciate you airing this.
Right. Well, I think I've got a good quantity of material here to work with now.
Excellent, Matt.
Anything really obvious that I missed that you want to point out?
Well, when you air it, well, first of all, what I need is the link to your website and when you're going to air it, if you happen to know, just so I can put it on my blog so people can listen.
Yeah, sure.
That'd
I don't
be
know.
Helpful.
I don't know the air date yet, but Our web address is tristatesradio.com. So tristatesradio, all smushed together, .com.
Okay. Are you going to be at the lecture?
If I can.
Okay.
I'm going to have to.
I'm going to have to check out.
It was November 1st. Off the top of my head, I'm going, where am I November 1st?
But just say hello.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tristatesradio.com, no hyphens.
No hyphens, yep.
Yeah, and then did you get any of the music? Do you have any of my recordings? Do you have the two CDs? Because, I mean, you're going to play presumably some music around the interview, right?
Yeah, I'm going to try to pull some. Looking in there, I've got. I was surprised by how thin our stacks were.
Oh yeah,
on Pepper.
Well. He didn't do that many dates as a leader.
So what I'm able to pull from is a little bit from some prominent moments on Chet Baker dates.
Okay, that'd be fine. Thad Mell would be another choice.
Right.
I would recommend strongly Donald Byrd, Pepper Adams, because their quintet was a band for, if you have the Mosaic box, the complete Blue Note, Pepper Adams, Donald Byrd, they were a band for 5 years, and they discovered Herbie Hancock, so Herbie's on the last few records, Chick Corea's on one of them when they recorded later on in the late 60s. Probably the most famous thing that Pepper ever did is Monin on Blues and Roots, the Mingus Tape Blues and Roots on Atlantic, which you probably have in your library. It's been used on so many movie soundtracks, like the Jerry Seinfeld documentary and Bowling for Columbine. It has that introduction.
Right.
A lot of people recognize that. So that's the tune Monin. And then his two favorite recordings, which you may or may not have, are the ones on Muse. One's called The Master, and one's called Reflectory, and anything from there would be incredible. I guess you're going to air this in the next few days, so probably you cannot get my CDs from the record company in time. Although maybe John Vanna's got them. You might want to ask
That's a good point. Yeah, I can try there, and I've got
Vanna
at home.
Vanna? How does he pronounce his last name?
Vanna.
Vanna, okay. Yeah, so he probably has that stuff. And he also is a huge Pepper Adams fan, so he might have those recordings. He's asked me to bring out for him some of the most obscure stuff in my library. I mean, nobody else cares. This stuff's really, really obscure. So that presumes that he's got all the other stuff, the most obvious stuff. So, yeah, the Reflector and the Master. His nickname was the Master, by the way, among the older musicians like Milton That's the kind of respect that he had. And, you know, there aren't too many people. You can three notes, you know who it is, you know? I can name like five of them, and Pepper's one of them.
Wow.
And that's mean about being a stylist. You know, there aren't that many anymore, especially. Well, thanks for doing this. Can I give you my email? Do you have my email?
Let me see here. I don't see the No, I don't see it.
All right, so it's G. Carner. Don't say H. Carney. G. Carner. So it's G-C-A-R-N-E-R.
Yep.
At gmail.com.
Okay.
And if you could just shoot me an email when you know when this thing's going to be aired, I'd appreciate it. Then I can put it in my blog. I'm doing a travelog on my blog. And you might even want to mention it. So I didn't even mention my website. It's pepperadams.com. If you can put a plug in for that, that'd be wonderful, because it is the clearinghouse of all things Pepper Adams. A huge amount of information there. Okay, man. Well, thanks again.
Hey, thanks too.
Sure. Bye.
Bye.